It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Soze!
No, that's Matthew Soze.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yeah.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Soze.
Film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soce. The show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, are available on Spotify. Dipping into the archives for the intro, yes, Scott Hoke doing the original introduction to this program. So, and for you longtime listeners, you know Scott's voice. And yes, a little bit of Cheyenne music from Once Upon a Time in the West. Yes, we are going to be very Ennio Morricone heavy on this week's show because of the passing of the great Ennio Morricone earlier this week at the age of 91. We'll get to my discussion with Brian Hartz, one of my favorite guests, not named Monica. It's the Hartz family. They know. But we're going to play a chat that I had with Brian on Monday after we both heard separately of Morricone's passing on Monday morning. But there is a slew of stuff I want to get to first, then the Morricone discussion, and you'll hear clips from some of his scores, not all 500 plus of them. And then grab a pencil. We will get to what you folks and what I've been watching over the past week. Right out the gate, opening today, actually, courtesy of IFC Films, is the thriller film called Relic, and this is available on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, YouTube, Vudu, PlayStation, Xbox, Comcast, Infinity, Spectrum, Verizon, DirecTV, AT&T, Cox. So look for it. But it's courtesy of IFC Films, and they're IFC Midnight, which means the film's gonna be scary. But it has it's primarily a three-person show. You have Emily Mortimer as the daughter. Her mother is not doing well around the house, and things are going bump in the night, along with bad dreams, along with strange noises. It's a haunted house movie, but it's a little more than that. Rounding out our cast, playing Emily Mortimer's mother, the grandmother, it's Robin Nevin, Australian actress who was in such films as Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, Careful He Might Hear You, and if you're a fan of The Matrix, she was Counselor Dullard. And Dillard, wow, sorry. And then playing the Emily Mortimer's daughter is Bella Heathcote. She played Jane Bennett in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Also appeared in Neon Demon, 50 Shades Darker, and Tim Burton's Dark Shadows. And it's written and directed by Natalie Freca James, and this is her first full-length film. It's under 90 minutes, which helps. It takes a while to get into. If you're expecting wall-to-wall scares, you're not going to get that here. You're getting set in tone at first what seems like a domestic drama with grandma has a habit of wandering away from the house, and daughter and granddaughter have not seen her, so they investigate at the house. And when they find her, they wind up staying at the house to make sure she's okay. I would say if you wanted a more subtle but not as good a version of Hereditary, because as the film goes on and gets scarier, it's also symbolic of parental care. And the three performances of the three ladies are very good. And when it's all said, and I think it also depends how much you enjoy this based on when you pick up on it, if you're listening to this review, and I've kind of given it away. But it does have the what you need as far as haunted house movies, but it tells a little bit more. So it's worth checking out. There are a few disturbing moments, especially with the bruisings that appear on Grandma, and the film explains that. So if you're a fan of films like The Babadook and Hereditary, it's not as good as those, but it's still worth checking out. It's a Friday, Saturday night popcorn and carbonated drink show for you. So anyway, that is out there. That's Relic, and it's available on IFC Midnight. Virtual PopCon is this weekend. It started earlier today. So that's Indie PopCon or PopCon. So anyway, you can go to @IndiePopCon for all the information and how to check that out. You also have Can, that's K-A-N-K-A-N, indie.com for all the stuff happening virtually over at Can Cinelog, among other things. So give my regards to them, if you would, please. Indie Shorts International Film Festival is running July 21st through the 26th. Tickets are on sale now. You can go to heartlandfilm.org for all the information, and congrats on everybody involved with that. All right, heading over to the drive-ins over at the Tibbs. They're going old school on Screen One. They are doing the original Friday the 13th, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and the original Halloween. Way to go. There you go right there. Screen Two, Palm Springs. That's the new comedy with Adam Sandberg and J.K. Simmons. And on Screen Two, Archive. Screen 3, The Empire Strikes Back and Spaceballs. And on Screen 4, Relic, which I just talked about, along with the Lulu Wilson, Kevin James thriller, Becky. That is all happening at the Tibbs Drive-In. Over at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, this weekend they're showing Tommy Boy at 9:30, Dazed and Confused at 11:30, and then at 1:30 a.m. on July 11th only, they're showing The Empire Strikes Back. So go check that out. You're listening to The Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. I'm your host, Matthew Soucy, and I want to get into the Ennio Morricone portion of the program. Not just my favorite film composer, but my favorite composer, if one keeps a list of favorite composers. The man changed movie music as we know it, and we are all the better for it. And he passed away earlier this week at the age of 91. And on Monday, I talked with Brian Hartz, who's been a regular guest on the show and a film score enthusiast and expert in his own right. So here's Brian and I saluting, many salutes to the great Ennio Morricone. Brian, what was your introduction to Ennio Morricone?
That's a good question. I've been actually trying to think about that today, trying to figure out just when this guy who's just in our collective musical unconscious actually floated into my conscious mind. I think I it might have been rolling around with my parents or my mom in her car, because I think she listened to like oldies radio stations all the time when I was a kid, and I think they'd occasionally play the like Hugo Montenegro pop version of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. either that, or I have a distinct memory of watching the movie Two Mules for Sister Sarah with my dad.
Okay.
It was just like randomly airing on a Sunday afternoon on like Channel 4 or something. And, the title sequence of that movie came on. I thought, what is this? This music is crazy. You might recall the main theme from Two Mules for Sister Sarah. He actually makes the orchestra bray like a donkey. It's pretty amazing. That's something that makes you sit up and take notice. That's as close as I can remember. It seems like Morricone is just one of those musical presences. It's always been with you, but as far as I can remember, that might have been my introduction.
It's funny you mention, because he's also, I mean, you are of a certain age and I am older than your certain age. But the music of Morricone, especially the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly theme, that's something people know whether they have ever seen the movie or not. It's just a part of the pop culture music riffs.
Yeah, that single theme, I can think of nothing besides the two-note Jaws motif that is more buried in people's musical conscience, just out there in the zeitgeist. And yeah, you don't have to be familiar with it at all to know what it means. I mean, my daughter was watching an episode of The Magic School Bus on Netflix a couple of weeks ago, and there's a scene where they go to a desert and a tumbleweed rolls by, and sure enough, you know. And I said, boy, I sure hope Ennio Morricone is getting royalties from that.
One would hope. I'll get to my daughter's story in a little bit. But it's funny you mentioned that. I think also the theme from Dragnet could also be in that bare minimal, but everybody knows it, sense of the riff.
Yeah, or Bernard Herrmann's Twilight Zone theme, or perhaps Lalo Schifrin's Mission Impossible.
That's very good.
Those are the musical phrases that have just become disembodied and part of us.
And also, I you heard me earlier when you mentioned Hugo Montenegro. I think that's also that's a 60s example of pop culture debaggery. If you're a true music fan, you own the soundtrack to the good, the bad, and the ugly. If you're just half-assing it, you have Hugo Montenegro. Yeah, Don Draper would have Hugo Montenegro, I think, in his collection. So
on the hi-fi.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it's funny that, and, you know, it is the Pat Boone tutti frutti of the Western music score world. So
Pat Boone, who himself appeared on a couple of Western scores, I think.
Yeah, but they weren't Italian Westerns, were they?
No, certainly not.
That would have been something.
Wasn't he in Rio Bravo? Am I thinking of the right?
No, that's Ricky Nelson.
Ricky, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of wrong white bread pop singer.
Brian, I'm stunned you don't know more. You don't have more knowledge of John Wayne Westerns.
You know, I've seen a few.
Okay. So, all right. So weird. Getting back to you'd mentioned. Did Bebe recognize anything about the tumbleweed scene in Magic School Bus, or did she see you laughing?
Not at all.
Okay. All right.
No, of course not.
Just checking. For the record, folks, I've been bothering the Hartz family to show their daughter just a myriad of movies for years, and this is just adding to it. So
she's just shy of six. So I think perhaps not quite ready to see shots that roll on for 10 minutes at a time of the flinty gaze of Clint Eastwood.
Oh my gosh! All right, fine. Well, okay. My story on this was, and it's very similar to with what you went through. My daughter Emma, she had to have been maybe 10 or 11 or 8, 9, say, because it was back when we were living in on the east side of town. But she came down one Sunday morning, and Lynn was asleep, and I was downstairs, and she said that she watched an episode of Hannah Montana that had a squirt gun fight. And she goes, it looked like it was shot like one of your movies.
Uh-huh.
With the music and the extreme close-ups and the squinty eyes and all that. And I said, yeah, that's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And what every father wants to hear from a 9, 10-year-old daughter, do you have it?
Nice.
Yes. Can we watch it? And I spent a very lazy Sunday morning watching. We got through the first 2 hours of it. Of the good, the bad, and the ugly, and then she the attention span still kind of waned, but she did finish it, and then she took my Man with No Name trilogy DVD collection and took it up to her room, and that's what she watched for a couple of weeks.
Nice.
So now part of it is, as I, from a film fan standpoint, every shot in a Leone film is suitable for framing, every single shot.
But with the
music, folks, and I'm hoping the news reports have been on this. He was one of the first, if not the first, to incorporate electric guitar into film scores. And also, as you mentioned, he had this myriad of noises and sounds, and there were human voices, but they weren't actually saying anything. They were vocalizing or braying, and it was absolutely fascinating that it had never been done up until that point.
I was just thinking, man, I would love to have been sitting in a movie theater in the United States in 1967, because of course it took 3 years to hit the States for them to redub it in English, to see the premiere of A Fistful of Dollars, and just hear how people reacted to this bonkers score. I mean, we forget that now because Ennio Morricone so totally redefined the idiom of Western film scoring. This was completely outside the experience of anybody in the theater. Aside from, you know, some, you know, Mexican-flavored trumpet here and there, Morricone's scores bore so little resemblance to what everybody was used to as Westerns. Westerns sounded like Aaron Copland. They sounded like Tex Ritter. They sounded like, you know, the great Elmer Bernstein's, you know, Magnificent Seven. Dmitri Tiomkin, you know, the very broad Americana orchestral scoring and, in this sort of very, like, cowboy song, Roy Rogers tradition. And then to come with this intense avant-garde jangle of, you know, full orchestra plus, you know, random sounds plus instruments like recorders and electric guitars and things, you know, no sane person in 1967 would have thought belonged together. How did that hit people?
Like a ton of bricks. The fact that, what, it's over 50 years later and we're still talking about it.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, you're right. I think the fact that, you know, I grew up on it and you also grew up on it, that it had been so ingrained it would be a hell of a lot different 50 years ago, almost 55 years ago than it would be now. Since we've been bringing this up, I want to share with everybody, here is a little selection from the first three Sergio Leone Westerns, A Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, and of course The Good and the Bad and the Ugly, all done by Ennio Morricone.
Thank you.
That was snippets of music from A Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, all written and composed by Ennio Morricone, who passed away earlier this week at the age of 91. The man had over 500 credits, if you go to his IMDb page. And when the spaghetti western boomed in the 60s, there's a couple documentaries about the history of spaghetti westerns, and it was one thing if you made a western and you were able to but it was a bigger deal if you were able to get Marconi to do your music for you. And I know he did that with Sergio Corbucci's Django. And The Great Silence is another one that comes to mind. He was able to rattle them off pretty quickly, but it did add a little bit of credibility to the other no budget Western that didn't have his music in it.
Yeah, well, 2 points on that. First, God, the man was a machine. Looking through his IMDb credits, you just see in the same year, like 6, 7, 8 movies.
Mm-hmm.
I do not know how he did that. A career spanning roughly 60 years, 520 credits. You do the math.
Yeah.
But that's a lot. even though he slowed down a little bit in his later years, like there's one very last entry on his IMDb page that says it's still in pre-production. So he was contracted to work on yet something else. But yeah, with the Western scores. In particular, he just elevated it to a different level because the spaghetti westerns, obviously you can't ignore the visual and thematic contributions of people like Sergio Leone, but he was the one who set the tone, set the style, set the mood for all of that. In fact, one thing that I've discovered, which is fascinating, is like most of the score of Fistful of Dollars was actually written in advance. And In that way, Morricone might actually have helped to define Sergio Leone's style. You think of all these shots that are held for a very long time while the music builds. And Leone said that he was actually inspired to hold shots in editing longer than he would otherwise have done just to let Morricone's music play out, because of course that original Fistful of Dollars score was pre-recorded. So you might have Morricone to thank for Leone's editing style.
Then, and that's the first thing I thought of is the final shootout in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is my favorite. That and The Wild Bunch are my favorite shootouts in a Western movie ever. And it makes sense that you say that because of the build of the music. So that's why we have so many close eyeball shots and flickering hands before the final moment.
It's amazing. That cue plays out for, 9 or 10 minutes. And you'd think, I mean, God, I'd love to try to watch that without the music. Drumming your fingers at the fourth shot of Eastwood's Crow's Feet, But, man, with the music, three guys staring at each other becomes practically opera.
Yep. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned that. Would you share? You made a comment about opera and Morricone on my Facebook page.
Yeah, basically. I think you posted that final confrontation.
I did.
I said basically Morricone composed operas that happen to have gunfights in them.
Right. And I wonder of, yeah, because that it's just it's riveting as hell. It's unreal. I would love to see an orchestra perform that live someday. Well, I'd love to see any orchestra perform, period, but that's another discussion for another time. Once Upon a Time in the West his first American film? Because I know Paramount back that initial originally from the get-go, or did they distribute it?
I'm not sure about that. I think it was American produced, though.
Okay.
But the internet will know.
Yes, that's true. And I know I was trying to figure out where he started out in Hollywood. And I know you mentioned Two Mules for Sister Sarah, which would be another one of his early Hollywood inputs. But it's interesting that that's the only composer Leone worked with. So you have four great Westerns, one fascinating Western, which I'm going to watch again this week. And then
which one would that be?
That would be Duck, You Sucker.
Or Or
A Fistful of Dynamite. And then, of course, you have to see the proper version Jewish gangster movie, Once Upon a Time in America, which introduced the world to Zamfir. And it's the only time Zamfir is not a punchline.
Yes.
From Once Upon a Time in America. That's the music of Ennio Morricone. He died earlier this week at the age of 91. Have you seen Once Upon a Time in America, Brian?
You know, I picked it up when it was on sale on Amazon like a year or two ago, and it's still sitting on my shelf. I need to actually open up the case and throw it in the fire.
No.
I haven't gotten to it yet.
Well, I think during the pandemic, this has become I got the pile. Let's chip away at it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely have had the opportunity to chip away, but that one has not been shipped yet. It's a commitment. It's like a 3-hour epic.
I was going to ask which version you had, because that's one you have to be on the lookout for, which version that is available.
I believe it is the extended cut or whatever the longer one is.
Okay, all right, good.
Well, I'll turn around and look at my shelf. It's right behind me. yes, extended director's cut.
Okay, good. You're set.
Good, Joe, I got your version.
Yeah, during the pandemic, it's funny. Going back to the pandemic. I shouldn't hear anybody complaining about the length of a film if you're stuck at home.
You know what? Yeah, it passes the time. Sure does.
By the 70s, Morricone was doing a lot of stuff in Hollywood. And for me, Brian, the first non-Leone work I've discovered of his, and it turned out to be one of the first compact disc I ever bought, but it was his soundtrack to Roland Joffe's The Mission.
Oh, yeah. Another score that I stumbled into via other means. You might recall that they co-opted the main theme from The Mission for Colombian coffee commercials in the late 80s.
Oh, my gosh.
90s. And so when I finally got around to seeing The Mission, I was in high school, I think, in the mid-90s. And I heard the music. I'm like, wow, this is great. It feels familiar. Wait a minute, this is the coffee music.
So did the commercials have somebody on a crucifix going down a waterfall?
I don't know if that one passed the standards and practices for network TV. Poor Juan Valdez going over the waterfall.
There's jokes there, we're not going to do them. I'm not doing that. But yeah, I think that and Peter Gabriel's Passion were like two of the first kind of major soundtrack purchases for me.
Those are solid choices.
Mm-hmm.
No, Morricone actually, his score. Boy, if you compare his scores to the spaghetti westerns with The Mission, you'd hardly believe you were hearing the same composer, except for like some of the broad chord structures he has and things like that. almost like listening to Out of Africa era John Barry versus James Bond. and that's another hallmark of a great musical mind, is the ability to switch between genres, because he draws on very classical influences for the Mission with the beautiful oboe theme, which has been performed in concert many a time by oboists. I'm sure it's one of their favorites to pull out in concert. But also the speaking of South American influence with Sampir, the South American chorus of the Guarani. For those unfamiliar, I guess we should mention, because this movie has kind of been forgotten unfairly, because it's a beautiful film.
It is. I was 16 when I saw it in a theater and was just bowled over by. And it's Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons, who are Irons is a missionary. De Niro is a former slave trader that converts to Christianity, but they and the two men have an argument, have a disagreement over how to handle slave trading battles. Do you do it with a kindness and I guess to borrow a line from another film he did music for, The Untouchables, is it better to have a gun and a kind word than just a kind word?
Yes. Or do you do it the Chicago way?
Right. And we'll actually. And by the way, before we get back to the Mission, your thoughts on the Untouchables score? I had a friend who said it was the worst soundtrack he'd ever heard, and I think that's really not true.
I think it's way off the mark. I don't know that it's aged as well as some of his others, just because there's a lot of very like 80s hallmarks in it. But then again, it features a lot of his trademark layering of different themes and different styles of music. And as my friend Amy, fellow film buff Amy Eckert, put it this morning when I was chatting with her, she said that, yep, it's the music that's been used in every Oscars memorial montage.
Oh, jeez. Wow.
Amy? So I was actually just listening to a bit of The Untouchables earlier this afternoon, and it's like surprisingly lyrical. You forget how just sort of romantic it is for a basically a hard-nosed David Mamet scripted movie about busting up cartels.
Well, and I showed it to Emma. Actually, I showed it to my family earlier near the beginning of the pandemic. And I still think it really holds. I love the chugging intro and the use of music in the Union Station, as well as Al Capone's use of baseball. I think it holds up very well.
Yeah.
So you mentioned something on my page about the Mission, about Morricone watching it. Could you share that with the audience?
Yeah, I was sort of digging around and looking at stuff, because the Mission happens to be one of my favorite films and probably my favorite Morricone score. But I found a quote from Roland Jaffe, the director, and forgive me if I'm pronouncing it wrong. I don't know exactly how to pronounce Roland.
That's all right.
Name. But he was talking about when they had the first screening for Ennio, as he was preparing to score the film. One of the producers was Italian and brought Ennio to the project. And he said, when Ennio first saw the Mission, this is a quote, by the way, it was a cut that had some other music, something classical. At the end of the screening, he was weeping. I could see he had tears running down his face. I came up to him and he burst out in Italian. What he was saying was that he couldn't make the music for this. He was too affected by it. That's a good sign, my producer assured me. When Ennio says he can't do it, he usually does something extraordinary.
And with that, here's a sample of music from Roland Joffé's film, The Mission, with music composed and conducted by Ennio Morricone.
Thank you.
That was music from The Mission, written and composed by Ennio Morricone, who passed away earlier this week at the age of 91. Brian Hartz is on the line with me, and I know we both have our IMDb on our scrolling in front of us as we speak. Going through some of his stuff, and we're both pro physical copies of things, and it was one of those that anytime anything of his would pop up, fairly inexpensive or not, I would get it anyway. But like, I remember finding his score to Franco Zeffirelli's version of Hamlet. And snagging that for my collection, even something with Oliver Stone's U-Turn. What do you have of his in your collection?
I own relatively little of it, and I probably ought to change that.
Sorry, put you on the spot there.
Oh, that's fine. I've got The Mission and a few of the obviously the Dollars trilogy. Scores.
Mm-hmm.
I probably ought to try to snag a copy of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly on vinyl. It's actually relatively easy to come by because it was a huge hit.
Cool.
It's one of those things. But yeah, as far as actual physical copies of his stuff, I have a relatively little, unfortunately.
Okay.
Although you just reminded me of his Hamlet score. I'd forgotten about that, and I even watched that version of Hamlet, not so long ago as I was preparing to play Hamlet myself.
Scrolling through some of that stuff, going through his work, and of course another artist who was able to pick up and bring him to a whole new audience was Quentin Tarantino.
Indeed. I have mixed feelings about his relationship with Tarantino, and I think he did for a while too.
He did.
Picking up his music and plugging it into his movies, whether it fit there or not.
Now, did he get royalties for that? Even though he was not a fan of the use of his music willy nilly,
I would have to assume that he did. In fact, I sure hope he did. Otherwise, I'd have even more of a problem with it than I do. Tarantino. I think he first started cribbing from Morricone when he did Kill Bill, and it absolutely works in that context where you're just throwing, several genres in a blender and hitting puree. It's already, super, postmodern pastiche. Why not, throw some Morricone music in with, the Wu-Tang Clan and, Japanese pop.
Right. And I think he has done what I think a lot of us do in our own heads is if we're in either we're working on something or we're, in our everyday lives and you think of a piece of music that would go with that. And I think in his case, he was able to have the budget and the wherewithal to say, I want a piece of music from this. And he didn't always, and Quentin never picked the obvious ones. What's great, if you go through his soundtracks, you have to find out, all right, what film is this from the late 60s, early 70s, that was probably only made in Italy and barely got a release in the States?
Yes, I'm sure in Tarantino's basement, he has like racks full of 16 millimeter, film reels of like the only surviving copies of little, zero budget Italian films that Morricone might have been attached to.
There you go. It was an on again off again relationship. I think it ended well in 2016.
Well, it Morricone got a little gold statue to say so. Yes.
That's another. Okay. So do you have your IMDb up? Because I was going to quiz you on.
All right.
So he was. Yeah. He got the honorary award in 2007. Finally got it for the win in 2016 for Hateful Eight. Can you name the other five? He only was nominated five times.
Yeah, I know Malena got nominated.
Very good.
The Giuseppe Tornatore film from 2000.
And
second hottest Monica I know.
Monica Bellucci, yes. I found that at Half Price Books right before the pandemic hit. And I own the second best looking Monica at home. Okay, anyway, yes, but yeah, you got that.
Another Giuseppe Tornatore film, Cinema Paradiso.
No.
He didn't get nominated for that?
Did not. Can you believe that?
What a beautiful score that is.
I know. You weep at the end.
It's heartbreaking. It is.
It is.
I can't think about it without choking up, which is one of the reasons I haven't listened to it today as I've been marathoning his other stuff, because it's just a little too soon for that.
Uh-huh.
Well, The Untouchables got nominated. I'm
yep,
sure.
That's two.
Five others, huh?
No, there's three others. You got three more.
Three others. Oh, okay.
Yeah, but this,
The Mission was one.
Yep, that's three.
So probably going to come up short on the others, though.
Okay, now I will drop you hints. One was from the 90s, early 90s, directed by Barry Levinson. Had Warren Beatty in it.
Oh, Bugsy, that's right.
Yep. And then his first nomination, all right, so now we're going to get into old guys on the front stoop. The man who changed film scores didn't get his first Academy Award nomination until 1979 for a Terrence Malick film.
Oh, that would probably be Days of Heaven.
That is correct. Okay. That is correct. So I went through, and you know, we could save the discussion of the validity of the Academy Awards for another time, but I checked, you know, because originally The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was filmed in 1966 in Italy. You know what won the best score that year?
In 66?
Yes.
Whew. Off the top of my head, I couldn't say.
Born Free.
Oh, boy.
So it's just, you know, for lack of a better comparison, you think of somebody like Paul Newman or somebody like Al Pacino of this amazing body of work. And I don't think The Hateful Eight was throwing him a bone. It's a legitimate good score. And he was in his 80s and he cranked that out.
I don't know what to.
But I mean
keyboard sound effects.
No, that's fine. But I mean, you know, it's kind of like the Goodfellas effect of, you know, we're going to be talking. We are going to talk about his music till the end of whenever, regardless of what won in 64, 65, 66 and all the other famous themes that he was known for.
So the other nominees for the 2016 Oscars were Carol by Carter Burwell.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Sicario by Johan Johansson.
Also pretty good.
These are all solid. Bridge of Spies by Thomas Newman.
Sure.
And The Force Awakens by, of course, John Williams.
So
solid group. I'd probably have still given it to Ennio for that. That's a totally legit win, although it's also, you know, recompense for all the stuff he didn't get nominated for that has revolutionized film scoring. Although, to be fair, I'm not sure that Good, the Bad, and the Ugly would have been on anybody's radar in the Academy in its proper year when it was released in Italy. Because
that's true.
Even the first of the Dollars trilogy didn't get released in the States until the year after that.
That is correct. And I guess the honorary award in 07 kind of helps remind folks of his impact there. All right. With that in mind, here is a little bit from Ennio Morricone and the music, a little bit of the music from the Academy Award winning, I love saying that, Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. That was music from the Academy Award-winning score of The Hateful Eight, Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight, music by Ennio Morricone, who died earlier this week at the age of 91. So, Brian, Are you going to be able to listen? Will you listen to Cinema Paradiso, and you will you do it when your family's out of the house?
Well, those moments are a little bit hard to come by these days.
I'm cutting into it now. I'm sorry, but yeah.
But I mean, honestly, with the weirdness of these times and our COVID related stress and isolation, I've been known to get teary at episodes of My Little Pony that my daughter's watching. So, you know, I've got no shame anymore. I will listen to it and weep sometime soon.
Have you heard two other things that are in my collection? There's the Yo-Yo Ma plays Ennio Morricone. Have you heard that?
I haven't, but that sounds very worth listening to.
Be on the lookout for that. And there's also a tribute album called We All Love Ennio Morricone, which has everybody from Chris Botti, Celine Dion, Herbie Hancock does a really cool take on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly with Quincy Jones.
Nice.
Bruce Springsteen does Once Upon a Time in the West. Gabriel's Oboe is done by Morricone. Metallica does the Ecstasy of Gold.
I was going to say, Metallica for years and years has opened their concerts with their own electric rendition of the Ecstasy of Gold. So I'm glad that made it on there.
Yeah, and I think that's also been used in commercials. So, you know, so long as they're all getting it, that's fine, I guess.
I know there's a hip hop song somewhere that's sampled Ecstasy of Gold as well.
Well, and
I think has also been used in commercials.
Well, there's been a number of, I think Kool Moe Dee had a song called The Wild Wild West where they borrowed I don't know if they sampled it, but they basically did their own version of the whistle from
yes.
GBU. So
I remember that.
Hip-hop's impacted, I should say, from Morricone and the spaghetti western world, that's duly noted. If we knew the RZA, he would probably go for an hour on that easily.
Oh, without question.
All right. Well, Brian, I guess shifting gears for a little bit since I got you on, what have you been able to watch recently during all these shut-in times?
Wow. Yeah, a lot.
I'm going to guess, like, in my house, there are certain things you watch by yourself, and then when you have family time, you got to find something for the family.
Yeah, definitely. You know, been catching up with Beatrice on some of the back catalog of Disney movies that she wasn't familiar with before, because we own a whole bunch of them. So obviously she's up on Frozen and you know the more recent repertoire. But we've gone back and showed her things like Robin Hood and The Sword and the Stone and filling in her knowledge. So that's been some good family time. Introducing her to some of the greats. And of course, you know, everybody had to sit and watch Hamilton. It seems like everybody I know had to stop everything and check out Hamilton when it premiered this past weekend.
Although
Mary may debate that point.
Yeah, and I know what there's. Well, as I was watching it, I think for a lot of people, because yeah, we got Disney Plus last week, and and I think for a lot of people who have, this is going to be eye-opening for them if they have never been to Broadway HD or National Theater Live. I bet there's a slew of people that probably didn't know that there are film plays and musicals.
Oh, yes.
And I think this film version of Hamilton is probably going to do for filmed theatrical performances what D.A. Pennebaker did for Monterey Pop and the music and the concert film.
I sure hope so, because that's the only way anybody's going to be able to see a Broadway show until at least the end of this calendar year.
Correct.
So, you know, I hope people can go back and discover things like, original cast recordings of. Actually, we just showed Bebe the original, Bernadette Peters version of Into the Woods. she adored that.
Well, she's got the rap down. I remember a couple years ago she had the Wicked Witch's rap down, and you guys filmed it.
She's slowly learning the words. She just sort of mumbles things she doesn't quite get. So I assume in another couple of years she'll have all the words to that.
Nice.
And then we'll start her on Hamilton.
How did she like Hamilton?
Oh, she adored it. I mean, she's been listening to the music since she was like less than 2 years old. She used to, you know, when she was very, very little, used to ask mom to play Hampton in the car. So she's absorbed with this. Yeah, she asked us to pause the I keep wanting to say movie. Yeah, why not?
That's fine.
Pause the movie so she could go up and grab a princess dress from her playroom so she could twirl around and sing along with the Schuyler sisters. So.
Excellent.
That's pretty wonderful. I have to say.
I think what also helps, first off, the editing of the performance is seamless. I know they did, I think, three nights, and also there was one evening where they did it without an audience, so they could get the back shots.
And crane shots.
Yes,
that was what blew me away.
Yeah, it was extremely helpful because we've all seen. I mean, and it's not a dig on National Theatre Live and Broadway HD. We've seen those; they're well done. I think we're also used to our parents with the handheld video camera edition of a play, which don't do that, folks. But so yeah, the fact that we had some camera movement and some sweeping and some close up. I mean, it was it's not like seeing it live, but it's probably the best we're going to get for a while.
Well, when you've got Disney's money, you can do a lot of production angles. You can shoot it from many, many angles when you've got the mouse behind you.
And you can get rid of a couple F-bombs as well.
Well, you know.
I know. Well,
as Lin-Manuel Miranda said, he literally gave two Fs to get it down to a PG-13.
All right, that was clever. I like that because I know when they took out the one from Adventures in Babysitting, I was really, really snarky. But I like Lin-Manuel Miranda's response to that better. That's good.
Well, we could get into Disney Plus's questionable editing practices later.
No, that's fine. Yeah, we broke in, Emma, with 10 Things I Hate About You and then Hamilton. So we're just kind of looking
nice.
To see what else they have. Yeah.
Well, that's a whole other topic we could talk about another time, the Shakespeare as teen comedy.
yeah, She's the Man and that and... it's not Shakespeare, but has BB seen Clueless?
Not quite ready for that one.
Okay, all right, just check it. See, we parents at home, we have barometers with our kids, and I'm always checking the Hartzes. So,
well, you can be sure she's going to be probably caught up on the full Disney catalog by the time we hit the all clear.
I'm sorry, the Don Bluth material.
Don Bluth.
Sorry.
Well, he left Disney. He went renegade. His stuff was his own. But yes, in fact, she has seen American Tale and Land Before Time.
Oh, very good, very good.
Don Bluth was killing it in the '80s when Disney was slumping. So.
Well, that was that weird. Well, by the '70s, with the live-action stuff, that wasn't doing that great. And then,
yes, how many Herbie sequels can you possibly stand?
Or everyone's favorite super dad, Bob Crane.
Yes.
The less we talk about that, the better.
I think. Well, we could hardly have talked about it less.
No, that's fine. That's fine. But I'll save that for another time. Cool. No. What else have you guys been watching?
Well, my dare to Monica lately has been to have her introduce me to movies that I've seen that are some of her favorites.
Yes, you had to watch Urban Cowboy.
Yeah. Monica's mom was a big John Travolta fan, so Monica growing up got to see a bunch of John Travolta. Yeah, Urban Cowboy, basically, Saturday Night Fever in snakeskin boots.
Yep. Yeah,
a lot of it holds up.
I was
just
go ahead.
Watching it, thinking about how much less urgent movie making was at the time, and that's not a slight. It's just it actually takes its time and tells its story in sort of an impressionistic way, rather than just trying to hit as many story beats as you can in as short as possible time.
That's true. Okay, so here's one since Monica's not there. Has she seen Blowout?
We're talking about Antonioni?
No. We're talking De Palma.
Oh, De Palma.
Not Blow Up.
No, Blow Up. Oh, sorry. I got my
Our voyeuristic may have recorded a murder film. Sorry. Yes. No, that's fine.
Actually, I haven't even seen that one.
Ooh. Look for it. I have it. It was funny because on Criterion's. It is on Criterion, but they had for July 4th, what was your favorite film with fireworks? And so many people mentioned Blowout, which I don't want to blow it for. Don't want to give it away for anybody. But it's one of those, I actually prefer De Palma's version over Antonioni's. And this was a, I was also, it was came out in the summer of 82, and it was, you know, it was supposed to be a quote unquote adult role for Travolta. It was not, he wasn't dancing. He was in a thriller this time, and they shot some of it in Philly. And my grandmother, my dad's side of the family's from Trenton. So it was kind of a big hullabaloo that they were able to shoot in Philadelphia and being in the region when that opened. But yeah, I would. So there's your challenge. Is if you can find a copy of Blowout, I would love to get your guys' input on that.
All right, we'll check it out. If there's nothing else, maybe we can find it streaming somewhere. Although if it's Criterion, they've got their whole other, they've got their own service now. So.
They do. And I'm looking at the shelf behind me. Here's my Criterion channel. What are you talking about?
Yep.
So. Well, Brian, I really, really appreciate your time and your input on paying tribute to a great man that has affected all of our lives, whether folks know it or not.
Absolutely. The influence of Ennio Morricone can hardly be overstated.
That's Brian Hartz and I talking about the great Ennio Morricone, who passed away earlier this week at the age of 91. Before I get to what I've been watching and in this case, listening to as well. I've been informed that the bookstore, you know, that one, it's a chain. It rhymes with Narns and Bobble. They have a Criterion sale, 50% off. So if you want to venture out and be safe and get physical copies, I guess you can order them online as well. So there you go. All right. Besides the movies, I listened to a lot of Morricone's work this week. Of course, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Once Upon a Time in the West. Of course, I played a little bit of both of those at the beginning of the show. Trio Infernale, one of the Italian sex comedies that he did music for. The Franco Zeffirelli film version of Hamlet with Mel Gibson. U-Turn, the not-so-subtle film noir from Oliver Stone. The Mission, of course, which I mentioned is one of the first soundtracks I bought on compact disc. And his Academy Award-winning score for Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. And I did go back and revisit The Mission, which, as Brian mentioned, is kind of a woefully underappreciated film. I remember it was the follow-up to Roland Joffe's film The Killing Fields. And it still holds, except for the casting. I know people are going to have issues with the South American priest being played by Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro. And Aidan Quinn is in this as well. But they shot it on location, man. That had to have been a haul, and it's a gorgeous looking film, and I still think that sparks the debate on how you are able to spread the word of peace and love, and how you defend it. So I think that still holds up. And then I revisited Duck, You Sucker, also known as A Fistful of Dynamite. Many would say the weakest of the Sergio Leone films. It's still pretty darn good. You have a Mexican bandit played by Rod Steiger and an IRA explosives expert played by James Coburn who become unlikely partners during the Mexican Revolution. What Leone wanted to do was demystify, deromanticize the idea of revolution, and he pulls it off here. Originally, I think Leone wanted Eli Wallach to play the Rod Steiger role. And wanted Eastwood in the Coburn role. Of course, that didn't happen. But Rod Steiger gets to choose some scenery, especially early on, doing his own version of Tuco. He mellows out a little bit in the second half of the film. Coburn plays it cool as usual, and as the film goes on, we find out more about Coburn's past in Ireland. But it's not quite the same drop as, say, Godfather 3, which I still say, as I mentioned last week, it's a good film. But it's not the masterpieces of the first two. It also doesn't help that A Fistful of Dynamite follows up not just The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, but Once Upon a Time in the West. So, but I would revisit it. And there is you can get the 2.5-hour version now, and it works. It really does work. It just happens. I guess there has to be a weak link in someone has to be fifth of the five films that Sergio Leone did. But it's worth checking out. All right. Going back to last week. Yes, we at the Soucy household got Disney Plus, and yes, we watched Hamilton. We have seen it live twice. Saw it in Chicago. And then Emma and I got to see the tour when it came through Indianapolis. And what I was jotting down in my notes was that this film version, and I guess it's nothing, there's nothing like seeing it live, and that's what we're hoping we get back to once all of this dies down. But because it was shot, I think it was three performances, and the editing is seamless. I think it's a great play. I think it's a great musical. I think it's the songs are great. The performances are excellent. What helped was they did it one night of filming with no audience. So you're able to get some of the back stuff and the top stuff and the crane shots. And so I think this film version of Hamilton could do for filmed Broadway performances what Monterey Pop did for the concert documentary back in the 60s with D.A. Pennebaker. And I think for a lot of people, this is probably many people's first experience with a filmed musical. And I mean, have not experienced National Theater Live or Broadway HD. So this could open up those floodgates for a lot of people. I hope. But I still enjoy watching it. This was the thing that my lovely daughter got hooked on and was playing it constantly and quoting it constantly. And I finally had to say to her, I had to warn her. I said, if it keeps going this way, I'm afraid I'm going to turn into every dad in the 50s with Elvis or every dad in the 60s with the Beatles, where we got burnt out by it. And much to her credit, she eased up. And I was able to finally, once we were able to finally see it, and I got bowled over by it as well. Dipping into stuff that I've had on the shelf and I've been needing to get through, I'm currently going through the commentary tracks on this, but I revisited the HBO miniseries of Mildred Pierce. That's the one that Todd Haynes co-wrote and directed with Kate Winslet as a divorced mom getting into the restaurant business back in the 1930s. Evan Rachel Wood, Melissa Leo, Mare Whittingham, excellent cast. And the thing is, I don't know if I've seen the original Joan Crawford Mildred Pierce, at least not from start to finish. And interestingly enough, on Twitter, Carrie Crow, who's been a guest on this show, said, "We watched the original the other night. We also watched A Kiss Before Dying last night." So thank you, Carrie. That's a little preview before you everybody grabs a pencil. But I'm glad I'm going to be intrigued to revisit the Joan Crawford Mildred Pierce, which was just a single film as opposed to the multi-hour series that I got to experience. My midnight movie last week after doing the Blues House Party, I'd mentioned before that the my Mystery Science Theater collection, except for the most recent reboot, is now complete. And the last of those films from one of the collections, Deathstalker and the Warriors from Hell, a medieval action film. It was an Argentinian United States production. One of those things where even though there's nature locations, the costumes don't match, and ooh, not my favorite genre, but it was anything I can do to wind down after a Saturday night is all right there. Yes, because it was July 4th, we did watch 1776 in the household. We are Socies. But at Emma's request, Emma and I watched Midsummer. She had heard about it and wanted to experience it and wound up liking it very much. And yes, disturbing, yes. And I had a few people on Facebook wonder, Emma and I have watched worse together, so this was fine. But the still holds up a great sense of dread, and as Emma really really appreciated, it's not about a cult; it's about breaking up with your boyfriend. So, but yeah, Midsummer in 1776. That's the Soucy household. We did also the next night watch Do the Right Thing at Emma's request, which she really, really enjoyed. And then I told her what nominations got at the Academy Awards and didn't get at the Academy Awards, and she became angry. So that's sometimes you poke the little hornet's nest that is my lovely daughter. So, yeah, that was pretty much. And I mentioned the Morricone scores from The Mission and DocuSucker. So That was the film week, and I'm hoping something that I ordered will be coming in the next few days, and it's going to be, I'll be talking about it quite a bit on next week's Film Sociology. All right, friends, you've had time. Grab a pencil. Let's go through what you've been watching over the past week. Going back to my buddy Eric, who loves Eric sends these. It's called I Watch Movies Number 17. So thank you, Eric. But a first time viewing for him, the laughable 1956 sci-fi epic Earth versus the Flying Saucers. Yeah, and then sometimes the film title, all you have to do is just deliver the title. And then he also watched for the first time the superb classic, he says, from 1945, Rome, Open City. His rewatches were the 1987 film The Untouchables, which he deemed smashing, and I showed that film to Emma and Lynn during the early stages of the pandemic. I don't think they liked it as much as I did, but I still enjoy the Ennio Morricone score. My buddy Jeff, I'm going to have to write him directly and find out his justification for calling it the worst soundtrack ever. I don't know why it sticks in my crawl, but I just think it's a wrong opinion, and I don't want to get into a fire match over such things. But anyway, The Untouchables was a rewatch, as well as The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. So good stuff there, Eric. Thank you very much for your contribution, as always. Going back to last week's list, which happens, our very own Bob Bloom wrote Mighty Oak. Mandolin writes The Vanishing of Sidney Hall, highly recommended. My cousin Kathy writes Game of Thrones. Mandolin also writes Jojo Rabbit and Overlord. Cassandra writes Hamilton. Okay, so it's not technically a film. We just got Disney Plus. It's okay, because of what we're going through as the IFJA, we are going to recognize it as because it was supposed to be a theatrical release. Taylor writes Kingsman: The Secret Service, I.O., Trumbo, Public Enemies, The Spy Who Dumped Me, My Darling Clementine, and a Mexican vampire wrestling movie. And Dogma. Thank you, Taylor. I actually watched an El Santo film because of Mystery Science Theater recently. John writes The Red Violin. Andy writes Xenon 2, the sequel. Craig writes The Last 5 Years. Jared asks, does Hamilton count? Yes, it counts. In our family, since released last Friday, we're at 7 times. Wow. You're a tougher man than I am, Jared. Man. And his kids aren't that young. Darren writes High Anxiety. Rebecca writes The Disaster Artist. I also plan to rewatch The Long Dumb Road, both on Netflix. Also forgot I also watched Clue over the weekend and recently caught the 36th cinema production of Petey Wheatstraw, The Devil's Son-in-Law, with Rudy Ray Moore. Very good. And the second season of Pose. Guy writes Goon. Well, he gives me a poster of Goon. I enjoyed Goon. Don't need the sequel, but still enjoyed it. Nikki writes, one that I would have come and found you so we could discuss it when I was in the building, Wakefield, the most bizarre film I've seen in quite a while. I will give you a call soon, Nikki. Jackie writes, Hamilton, Drop Dead Gorgeous, Ed TV, Eye in the Sky, and The Conjuring. Heather writes, Hotel Artemis. Jed writes, I watched Metropolis for the first time, blown away by the visuals and the Remember the Sultana documentary on Prime. I highly recommend. It talks about worst maritime disasters in United States history. An estimated 1,800 people died on the Mississippi River. John writes, per your post and discussion about Westerns, I watched a newer one called The Duel. The premise is decent, but casting Woody Harrelson in that role made the film hokey, and I didn't believe a word he said. Liam Hemsworth is the only reason I give the film 5 out of 10. Otherwise, I'd rate it lower. All right. James writes about Eurovision. It's pretty good. Maybe needed to get John C. Reilly in there to get it to peak performance. Joellen writes The Lodger and Athlete A. Maria writes The Blues Brothers. Brian writes Midway. Don't know which one. Which original or remake? Hamilton and The Hateful Eight. Maya. She writes Hamilton, Athlete A, Desperados, and Feel the Beat. Christy writes The Peanut Butter Falcon. Roxana writes Hamilton. Michelle writes, just ham. Abby writes, Spaceballs, Justine, Session 9, Dirty Dancing, and West Side Story. Michelle writes, Big Hero 6, I Am Not Fast, Michelle. Mrs. Falstaff, future Mrs. Falstaff. Inside joke here at Film Sociology. Lori writes The Adderall Diaries. Bonnie writes The Untouchables, 1776, Yankee Doodle Dandy, Rocket Man, and of course, Hamilton. Yes, Bonnie, you got to have James Cagney going down the stairs on July 4th. Joni writes, I wanted to watch Once Upon a Time in the West, but didn't have time. Haha. We watched Hamilton and Sunset Boulevard and Back to the Future. All right, Joni, but you got to get to Once Upon a Time in the West. It's great. Susanna writes, Saving Grace and Hamilton. Doug writes, Hamilton, The Lovely Bones, 1776, Yankee Doodle Dandy, Scaramouche, Muriel's Wedding, The Birth of the Blues, The Jungle Book, and Detour. Gregory writes, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Hamilton. That's a long day if you're doing those back-to-back. Joshua writes, Hamilton, Patriots Day, and United 93. Michelle writes, Lady Bird. Jamie writes, Hamilton, twice, and The Simpsons Movie. Catherine writes, Eurovision and Hamilton. Cassie writes, Hamilton. Kane writes, A Very Dark Films with Kevin James Called Becky. I thought, oh, I love Kevin James. Let's watch it. For your information, says action, should be horror. Also, the remake of The Magnificent Seven. John Krall, who's been on this show before, The Grapes of Wrath, Michael Collins, and A Walk in the Woods. Jeff writes, Once We're Brothers, Robbie Robertson and the Band, and Mockingjay Part 1. Tom writes, The Search for Sugar Man, or Searching for Sugar Man, or if it's a different documentary, not the one I'm thinking of. David writes, What We Do in the Shadows, Movie and Series. Devin writes, Hamilton. Cole writes, Eurovision. Cassandra writes, The Godfather and Ender's Game. David writes, The House That Jack Built, ooh, and Gaslight. Whoo, hopefully not back-to-back. Taylor writes, Bringing Up Baby, The Philadelphia Story, Dread, The Sign of the Ram, I.O., Harvey, The Untouchables, he points out Morricone score, My Favorite Year, Baby Snakes, After the Thin Man, The Spy Who Dumped Me, Pirates of the Caribbean, and Dead Men Tell No Tales. Julia writes, Hamilton and Maiden. Christian writes, The Mission. Andrew writes, I just got Disney Plus, so I'm catching up on Marvel movies, interspersed with The Love Bug, Wall-E, and episodes of House and The Mentalist. Rachel writes, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Molly writes, Hamilton, Eurovision, Jumping Jack Flash, and Her. Patty writes, The Bat, The Long Night, The Bribe, House on Haunted Hill, and Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day. And I know for a fact Patty watched the Vincent Price original version of House on Haunted Hill. Sorry, Jeffrey Rush. Steven writes, I went back and rewatched for about the 100th time Days of Heaven. John watched Particle Fever. Thank you, Steven. Teresa writes, Hidden Figures, again. Leanne writes, Magnificent Seven, 40-Year-Old Virgin, Kelly Clarkson, and Office Space. Sarah writes, The newest Charlie's Angels, just as fun as it was in theaters. Moretta writes, Hamilton, The Color Purple, just finished the book, and Frozen 2. Carrie writes, Wonder, There's Something About Mary, and Only the Brave. Hannah writes, Watched O Brother, Where Art Thou for the first time. Excellent. Very cool. Again, congratulations. Daniel writes, 8.5, Perry Mason on HBO. Summer Magic, Lover Come Back, The Skin I Live In, Send Me No Flowers, Sullivan's Travels, The Thrill of It All, The Piano Teacher, Billy Rose's Jumbo, Spellbound, The Celluloid Closet, Shoot the Piano Player, Euro Heart Vision, The Shaggy D.A., Anti-Mame, The Fallen Idol, and The Mask. Bob writes Fame-ish and Hamilton. Nick writes 7500, Cloak and Dagger, Greyhound, The Beach House, The Old Guard, and Assassin 33 AD. Joe writes Cyber Zone, Uncage, The Rental, Hamilton, Dark Encounter, Guns Akimbo, Mischief Night, Candyman, Spider-Man 3, Yes, God, Yes, Tijuana Jackson, Purpose Over Prison, The Half of It, and Assassins 33 AD. Mark writes A Bridge Too Far, which I mentioned is starring half of the Screen Actors Guild, and he adds in, and most of Holland. Goldman's script is livelier than I remember. If the film itself feels lead-footed and belabored, the performances and dialogue are solid, and you get a sense of the sprawl of warfare that most films don't provide. Chris writes, I tried to watch more of The Five Bloods. I think I'm giving up. A little bit of Eurovision, also Browse, Greyhound, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Raiders of the Lost Ark, pieces of various Marvel movies playing in the background of the hobby room. Understand. Leo writes, rewatched Fistful of Dollars, discovered that Leone and Morricone were some of the first to play music on set while shooting. Thank you, Leo. Annie writes, Patty and I binge-watched TCM's Vincent Price movies on TCM yesterday. That's what I figured, Annie. Thank you, buddy. Sam writes, rewatched Big, Road to Perdition, and Spotlight. Allison writes, Eurovision, which was awful. It was like Pitch Perfect, but without the interesting characters or plot, and with only one good musical number. Tickled, easily the strangest documentary I've ever seen. Allison, I can give you some titles. And Time Trap, not as bad as I expected. Evan writes, Assassin 33 AD, Fame-ish, Candyman, Beyond Skyline, Batman, Mask of the Phantasm, Oblivion, The Nice Guys, Air Force One, War of the Worlds, and Hamilton. Adrian writes, Saving Mr. Banks. Gary writes, Yo-Yo Girl Cop. That's it. It's been a slow week. Lou writes, a documentary on Kate Ballard. Hamilton, latest Apple family play, so good, and less blanks. Lisa writes, got sucked in by Rain on Netflix. Dustin writes, Hamilton, Lady and the Tramp, that's last year's version. Heavyweights, Recess, School's Out. Silver Linings Playbook, Harvey, Animal Crackers, Duck Soup, and Meet Me in St. Louis. That's for you, Bianca. Moveen writes, Judy, The Goldfinch, and Uncut Gems. James writes, Black Sunday, Exorcist 3, The Piano, and Pharaoh's Curse. Jeff writes, True Grit. Which one? Britt writes, Eurovision, The Story of Fire Saga, Harriet, Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, Hereditary, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, Austin Powers and Goldmember, Westwood Punk, Icon, Activist. Joe writes, Hamilton, Ford versus Ferrari, Harvey, and Old Yeller. And finally, Robert Muggy, who's been a guest on this show before, got to get him back, Border from Sweden, Synonyms from Israel, France, Germany, and all the Western noir films available on the Criterion Channel this month. Thank you, Robert, and thank you, everybody. I hope you got some titles, you got some ideas. As I mentioned, as I try to every week, hopefully you're doing a balance of films that you've seen before and they are cinematic comfort food, or in Jared's case, you watch Hamilton 7 times in 1 week, along with trying out titles you have not seen before, or new films, or if they are new to you, either one of those. So anyway, I hope you're staying safe, hope you're staying sane, hope you're staying healthy, hope you're being good to one another. If you get a chance to hit the drive-in, that's good. Theaters, we'll just have to wait and see. All right, friends, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. I want to end this week's show with another musical tribute to Ennio Morricone. Besides the myriad of soundtracks that he's done, we just scratched the surface, Brian and I. Go to IMDb and just scroll through those credits. You've heard his stuff, whether you know it or not. And there's a number of those are available for purchase, obviously, if I'm a physical copies guy. There's also a really cool collection called Yo-Yo Ma Plays Ennio Morricone, which is a collaboration between them and I believe the Rome Symphony Orchestra. And there's also a collection called We All Love Ennio Morricone, a tribute album that Sony put out back in 2007. Quincy Jones with Herbie Hancock, Bruce Springsteen, Metallica, Chris Botti, Roger Waters, Celine Dion, Renee Fleming, and others. And from that collection, we will hear the master, the maestro, Ennio Morricone. And Brian, get your tissues. I will too. Here's music from Cinema Paradiso. Thanks for listening. Grazie, maestro. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!